You are tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the continuation, the fulfillment of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, if you've been with us for a while, you'll know that very often I have another grateful Jewish entrant into the Catholic Church on the show as my guest, and I look forward very much to doing that next week, and perhaps even for the next 2 weeks. I am looking forward to having some friends that I recently met who filled that category, who will be on the show to explain how God worked very overtly in their lives to bring them to the truths of Catholicism. But today's show will be a little bit different, and it'll have a little bit of a more somber tone, for which I apologize in advance. But the discussion in today's show is actually going to center around the Holocaust, and the Holocaust seen through the eyes of Jewish theology, the Holocaust seen through the eyes of Catholic theology, and the effect that the Holocaust has had on Jewish theology and the way that it has colored Jewish theology for the last 60 years or so since the end of the Holocaust. So let me just begin. First of all, why spend the time discussing the Holocaust? And there are two basic reasons why it is appropriate to spend today's time doing so. The first is that one can't really understand the state of Judaism and the state of Jewish theology today without understanding the effect that the Holocaust has had on Jewish theology for the period, the last 70 years since the Holocaust. And the other is, frankly, that as Catholics, understanding more of the mystery of the Holocaust and where it came from and the relationship between Jews and Judaism with the Holocaust and with the forces that brought about the Holocaust actually shed some additional light on the role of Jews and Judaism in salvation history, and in particular in our current period of salvation history, and perhaps also in the period of salvation history, which is to culminate in the Second Coming, which, as Catholics, we know is bound to happen. It's an open question, of course, when, but we know that sooner or later, the full number of the human souls which God has intended to create for heaven will have been created, and at that point, life on earth as we know it will be brought to a close. The creation of additional human souls will be brought to a close, and all of man's existence from then on will be in the state of blissful intimacy with God in the New Jerusalem in heaven, certainly for all of the souls who have succeeded in their period on earth, and one may perhaps hope for all souls, but of course there's the very real possibility of some souls having been lost for all eternity. Anyway, but understanding there is a mysterious interaction between the role of Jews in Judaism and the Second Coming itself. And so that'll be in the background of today's discussion on the Holocaust. Having introduced that, let me just support that statement a little bit by citing paragraph 674 of the New Catechism of the Catholic Church, which states, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." And this is a statement in the Catechism of the doctrine which has been held since the earliest of the Church Fathers. It was extensively discussed by some of the early Church Fathers, including St. Augustine and St. John Chrysostom and St. Jerome and so forth, that in fact, shortly prior to the Second Coming, there will be a widespread conversion of the Jews. And so we know that the Second Coming can't happen unless there are, A, Jews around at the time, and perhaps even identifiably a Jewish community around at the time, and that a large part of that Jewish community around at the time finally comes to faith in Jesus and enters the Church. So with that as a backdrop, let me move on to the Holocaust itself. Now, the foundation of this understanding that I want to try to transmit is that the Holocaust, that is, the attempt to exterminate the Jews, because in fact that was the motivation behind that aspect of the Holocaust, was in fact not of entirely human origin, but that the impulse, the desire, the initiative to exterminate the Jews was actually an expression of the diabolical will. In other words, the expression of Satan himself and the expression of a satanic hatred of the Jews. Now, there are at least two ways that one can substantiate that statement. And the first that I will address is that, in fact, we all know that the impulse to bring about the Holocaust came through Hitler, but fewer of us are aware that Hitler himself was directly diabolically inspired. And let me support that statement a little bit. First of all, the chief exorcist of Rome, Father Gabriele Amorth, said, quote, "Without a doubt, Hitler himself was personally consecrated to Satan." Hitler's first springboard to public prominence, to a public position in the world, actually came from his activity with an occult society in Munich called the Thule Society. Now, a Thule was the Germanic version of the Atlantis myth. Thule was supposedly this mythical content in the Atlantic Ocean where the people had superpowers. They had mental telepathy. They could travel through the air and so forth. This continent sank beneath the waves of the Atlantic Ocean, but before it sank, that super race fled to Europe and from there to some extent to Asia and intermingled with inferior races and lost its superpowers. And in so doing, in the intermingling of this, you know, super racist blood with inferior bloodlines, they lost their superpowers. But if the purity of their bloodlines could be reestablished through selective breeding, they would regain the superpowers. And that, in fact, was the origin of the Nazi Superman myth. In other words, all of the attempts at selective breeding and at the purification of the blood in order to reestablish this super race, essentially of Atlanteans, or in the Germanic version, you know, of people from Thule. And that was actually the Aryan Superman, and that was the purpose of the blood laws and of the selective breeding. So we can see that the entire impulse behind that maintenance and improvement of the blood purity of the pure Aryans, which of course is a major component in Hitler's racism and extermination of inferior races, flowed directly from that occult society and from the occultism that Hitler was steeped in. Hitler, in fact, was the follower of an occultist named Adolf Lanz. And this line of occultism, by the way, that led into Hitler and the Third Reich had actually started in the late 19th century with Madame Helena Blavatsky, who is credited with being the foundress, the mother, if you will, of the New Age movement. Her stream of occultism at the time was known as Theosophy. And it became, you know, it flowed into the 20th century. There were a number of schisms and splits and divergences in her teachings. But most of the New Age today traces its heritage back to Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy, some relatively directly. One will find explicitly New Age streams called Theosophy today. There's also Anthroposophy, which was started by Rudolf Steiner, who was himself a protege of Madame Blavatsky, and so he, when he shifted a little bit the theology of the occultism that he taught, he shifted the name from Theosophy to Anthroposophy, but again, it flows back to Madame Blavatsky. This Adolf Lanz, who was a kind of a mentor or guru for Hitler, had twisted it, had given it a particular Germanic and Teutonic spin. It's easy to see the extreme racism to the point of genocide in Adolf Lanz's teachings. Let me read some of what he wrote. "The Jews are demonic beastmen who oppress us from above, slaughtering without conscience millions of peoples in murderous wars waged for their own personal gains. The inferior races, particularly the Jews, should be gotten rid of by methods including forced sterilization, castration, deportation, incineration as a sacrifice to God, and enslavement. Then that is the teaching of Adolf Lanz. Now let me read what Adolf Lanz wrote about Hitler personally. He wrote, quote, "Hitler is one of our pupils. We will yet be privileged to see that he, together with us, will win and will be able to establish a movement so powerful that it will shake the world." Close quote. In fact, Adolf Lanz had this very racist occultist journal that Hitler had had every copy of except for a couple, so much so that Hitler actually went over to visit Adolf Lanz to obtain the couple of issues that he had missing from his collection. I'm just trying to trace the kind of the overt occultism that was the foundation of Hitler's anti-Jewish racism. Now, as I mentioned, Hitler's first springboard to public power was an occult society in Munich called the Thule Society. The leader of the Thule Society in Hitler's day was an active occultist named Dietrich Eckart. This occultist that led the Thule Society boasted that he had, quote, and this is in reference to Hitler, that he had, quote, initiated Hitler into the secret doctrine, opened his centers of vision, and given him the means to communicate with the powers, close quote. So this occultist at the head of the Thule Society, Dietrich Eckart, boasted that he had personally initiated Hitler and opened his centers of vision and given him the means to communicate with the powers. Now, this is an occult initiation. From the point of view of the occultist, they believe that they're opening these centers of higher vision in the individual that gives them the means to communicate with the spiritual world. We know as Christians, we know as Catholics, that this is actually a demonic influence being introduced into the person, essentially some level of possession, not using that term in the precise sense, but there's some introduction of demonic entities into the person that then, in fact, do allow that individual to communicate with the power, so to speak, to communicate illegitimately with the spiritual world. But at that point, it will be, of course, the fallen spiritual world. It'll be the demonic spiritual world. And that's obviously the case when this occultist boasted that he initiated Hitler into the secret doctrine, opened his centers of vision, and given him the means to communicate with the powers. Now, I know this is a rather radical claim that I'm making, but if one gets a hold of Hitler's memoirs called Mein Kampf, which are basically, excuse the expression, but, you know, the Bible of Nazism, the very last paragraph of Mein Kampf is Hitler's dedication of the work to his beloved mentor, Dietrich Eckart. So this is all just a little bit of background to support my statement, which is actually just a quote of the chief exorcist of Rome, Father Gabriel Amorth, that Hitler was personally consecrated to Satan. Now, having established that background, if Hitler was personally consecrated to Satan, and Hitler's primary, I mean, he basically had two initiatives. One was conquering the whole world for the Third Reich, and the other was exterminating the Jews. Why should exterminating the Jews have such a high profile, essentially, for Satan? Why should the devil have such an active interest in exterminating the Jews? Now, there are at least two answers or two probable answers to that. One is just simply a diabolical hatred of the Jews. Of course, we know that the devil hates all of mankind with this incomprehensible fury and blind, almost blind hatred. He hates mankind for a number of reasons. One is, of course, that his pride was tremendously injured by the fact that when God created the angels, we know this from Catholic dogma, we know that Lucifer, who became Satan, was among the highest, if not the highest, and most glorious and most powerful of the angels. And the common thought in Catholic doctrine is that when God let it be known that he was going to create man and was going to create a member of the human race, that is, the Blessed Virgin Mary, who would have a stature above that of the angels, above that of Lucifer himself, that Lucifer, in essence, would be second to a human creature. On top of that, in some sense, you know, an ignorant peasant virgin, this was such a affront to his pride that he could not support that, and he rebelled. So we know that Satan has this furious hatred and envy, an envious hatred of the entire human race. It's focused on Jesus and the Blessed Virgin Mary, who were, for better or for worse, Jews. The Jews were the chosen people who were chosen to bring about the Incarnation and to bring about the Blessed Virgin Mary. So there may be a particular satanic hatred of the Jewish people. And if the Jewish people really are God's, the apple of God's eye, as it says in the Old Testament, then that too might make them a particular object of satanic fury. And finally, if the Jews are going to have, first of all, they clearly had a role in bringing about the first coming. They, in fact, had an indispensable role in bringing about the first coming, given that Jesus himself, of course, incarnated as a Jew. So, and it was the first coming of Christ that brought about Satan's fall. So that might be a reason for a particular satanic hatred of the Jews. But another reason might be that they, in fact, have a role in bringing about the second coming. We know from that paragraph of the Catechism of the Catholic Church that I cited that there have to be Jews around at the time of the Second Coming, and the Jews have to convert at the time of the Second Coming. So perhaps in some perverse way, Satan also thinks that if he can get rid of the Jews, or if he can prevent their conversion, he can prevent the Second Coming. So those are all hypotheses, hypothetical motivations, perhaps, for the incomprehensibly intense satanic fury against the Jews that was reflected in the second—excuse me—in the Holocaust. Let me read a couple of citations, some quotes from our Cardinal Archbishop Lustiger, Jean-Marie Lustiger, who was the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris. He passed away about 10 years ago, but before then, he was a Jewish convert himself. He was being hidden from the Nazis in a convent disguised as a young Catholic boy, and he came to the Catholic faith and as an adolescent entered the Catholic Church, ended up becoming a priest, ending up becoming a bishop, and then Archbishop of Paris and Cardinal. And he wrote a bit on the source of the Holocaust, the source of the Nazis' hatred of the Jews. So let me read some passages. These passages are from a book-length interview with him called Choosing God, Chosen by God. And by the way, if anyone's interested, these quotes I'm reading are also quoted in Salvationists from the Jews, which is my book on the role of Judaism in salvation history from Abraham to the Second Coming. So one can look into those quotes either from Salvationists from the Jews or from Lustiger's original book, Choosing God, Chosen by God. So let me just read these paragraphs. Hitler's anti-Semitism had its roots in the anti-Semitism of the Enlightenment and not in a Christian anti-Semitism. It was a refusal of the Jews' divine election, a hatred for their religious singularity. The Jews, as figures of election, caused jealousy and catalyzed on themselves the Nazis' negation of man and God. And forgive me, I can't find... here's the quote I was looking for. The Nazis were only weak creatures, puppets, immersed in an absolute evil that surpassed them. They were victims of their own ignominy. You may demonstrate that a particular person is a sadist, but you will have given only a limited explanation. You may show that this sadist controlled the levers of an immensely powerful machine that brought about an appalling death for his victims, but you are still faced with someone insignificant who does not suffice to explain what happened. That pathetic man is only a contemptible man, and it is normal that he should seem insignificant because the face hidden behind his is Satan's. It is the face of evil in our world, of evil's power, which is so vast as to be unimaginable for the human mind. Those men we see are only the servile actors. Yes, they are individuals who should be unquestionably held responsible for the crimes committed, but the evil that surged up in them infinitely surpassed them. It was not a war like the others. I felt that we had been plunged into an infernal abyss. At the heart of the opponent's ideology was the persecution of the chosen people, the Jewish people, because they are a messianic people. When, as a child, I spent time in Nazi Germany, I had understood Nazism's aim was more than Promethean. It was satanic. This utterly overwhelming conflict can be understood only within the mystery of the suffering Messiah and the redemption with the struggle it implies. End of quote. Now, there is a tremendous amount in that quote that I read, and more than I can unpack right now. But I just want to underline that Cardinal Lustiger certainly seconds this notion that the motive force behind the Holocaust, behind that incomprehensible, inhuman, satanic hatred and diabolical persecution of the Jews was in fact the diabolical itself, was in fact Satan's hatred of the Jews, and his having somehow, again, I don't want to use the word possessed because it has a technical meaning, but his very heavy-handed influence over the Nazis and over Hitler and over the insignificant and, as Lustiger says, contemptible individuals who served as puppets for his hatred of the Jews. Now, let me go on from there now and not exactly lighten it up, but perhaps lighten it up a little bit to go to the next stage in this line of reasoning that I wanted to indulge in today, which was the effect of the Holocaust on Jewish theology. Because if, from Satan's point of view, his intention behind the extermination of the Jews might have been to try to abort the Second Coming, to try to either eradicate the Jews so there could be no Second Coming, or prevent their conversion so that there could be no Second Coming, he obviously failed, thank God, in eradicating the Jews. He succeeded in at least slowing down the conversion of the Jews. He slowed down the conversion of the Jews in two ways. One is, if you heard my original witness testimony on the show, you'll know that when, frankly, Christ first revealed himself to me, I wasn't willing to accept that it was Christ, and I still wasn't willing to accept Christianity, and that came from being a child of Holocaust refugees, basically having been brought up in this atmosphere where I attributed this great, terrific persecution of the Jews to somehow an indirect outflow from Christianity, and that Christianity was the enemy, and that Christianity was the motive force behind the last 2,000 years' hatred of the Jews and behind the Holocaust itself. Now, we know as Catholics, and we know even from the little bit of quotes that I just read, that in fact, that's the opposite of the truth, that the motive force behind the Holocaust was not Christianity, it was the essence of the anti-Christian impulse. It was the satanic hatred of both Christianity and the Jews that came from the devil. But nonetheless, the Holocaust has certainly made it much harder for Jews to accept Christianity and to go over to Christianity. And perhaps even more tragically, the Holocaust has really thrown a monkey wrench into all of the Christian initiatives to evangelize the Jews or even to pray for the conversion of the Jews. And this is particularly true in the case of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had a number of institutions, at least six or eight, before the Holocaust, religious orders that were founded with the sole purpose of praying for the conversion of the Jews, sodalities and prayer groups and so forth, third orders that were formed to pray for the conversion of the Jews, a number of missionary initiatives, outreaches to the Jews to bring them to the truth of Jesus and so forth. And that activity has really dried up would be an understatement. That activity has really shut down after the Holocaust in the face of the Jewish community's ire at the Catholic Church following the Holocaust, and in the face of what's perhaps a kind of corporate sense of guilt that the entire Christian world has about having permitted the Holocaust to happen. I don't want to go into psychoanalyzing why the Holocaust has that indirect effect of stifling Jewish evangelization of the Jews and even Christian evangelization of the Jews, and even Christian and Catholic prayer for the conversion of the Jews, but it certainly has. And my main motivation probably for my apostolate or whatever it is and for these radio shows and so forth is to speak as a Jew and say basically, you know, if the Christian world is feeling guilty about anti-Semitism and wants to turn its back on anti-Semitism, there's no greater anti-Semitism than refusing to share Jesus with the Jews and refusing to pray for the conversion of the Jews and turning your back on bringing the Jews the greatest gift that God has ever given to mankind, which is basically the sacraments of the Catholic Church and the relationship between God and man, which is available only through faith in Jesus and the sacraments of the Catholic Church. And to deprive that of anybody is the greatest discrimination that you could possibly inflict on them. And to deprive the people who brought that great gift to the rest of the world and to the Gentile world, which means to you Catholics out of there, is a particularly ironic form of anti-Semitism, if you will. So this sense that it's somehow anti-Semitic or unfair to the Jews to want to see their conversion, to pray for their conversion, to try to bring them to the truth of the greatest gift that God ever brought mankind, which he brought through the Jews, is really seeing things backwards. So I realize now I've gone through the first half of the show already, so perhaps now is a good time to take a short break, and when we come back, I will talk more explicitly about the effect that the Holocaust has had on Jewish theology and contrast that with the infinite gift that Catholic theology provides for understanding the Holocaust and the role of suffering in our redemption. So I'll be back with you in a few minutes after this break.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Showman.
Hi, welcome back to Salvation is from the Jews for the second half of the show, which centers on the tragedy of the Holocaust and the tragic effect it's had on Jewish theology and contrasts it with what we are able to understand uniquely well as Catholics about the redemptive value of suffering. Now, before the break, I tried to substantiate that the Holocaust itself, the attempt to exterminate the Jews, was a direct expression of the satanic will, the diabolical will. The second half, I would like to discuss the effect that the Holocaust had, the negative effect, frankly, that it has had on Jewish theology since the Holocaust, and the way that we as Catholics are in a much better situation to understand the Holocaust, as well as the role of suffering in general in life. So first let me talk about the problem that has been introduced into Jewish theology by the Holocaust itself. Now, the reason I'm having this discussion, is because many of our listeners are obviously interested in Judaism, or they wouldn't be listening to this show, and are trying to understand the world of Judaism around them and the theology, the behavior, the belief system of the Jews who are around today. Now, the Jewish population today runs the gamut, a wide spectrum of levels of observance and levels of belief, as unfortunately is the case even in the Catholic Church. There are many people who consider themselves Catholics who do not actually believe in dogma, frankly. Don't believe in all of the truths that we know for certain as Catholics, and it's even more true in Judaism. So there's this spectrum where my guess would be in the United States, maybe 80% of Jews, probably at least 80% of Jews, do not really take the Old Testament at face value, do not take traditional historic Judaism, like the Judaism which existed at the time of Jesus, very seriously. And it's quite likely, frankly, that only perhaps 5 to 10% of Jews really, really, really believe in everything which the core of Judaism teaches. In other words, if Judaism had dogma, and in a sense it does have dogma, that's another discussion, but if it had a core of dogmatic teachings, I would guess that certainly under 10% of Jews today believe in everything that that core of Jewish teachings, which of course includes things such as the coming of a personal Messiah. So I don't know whether we have a caller. I'll have to get a message. We may or may not have a. Well, let me turn to the caller and see if that's in fact the case. If we have a caller, would you put them on?
Yes, we have Louise on the line.
Great. Louise, what's your question or comment?
Well, I just wanted to make a real short comment. And something popped into my head when I was listening to you. Earlier this week, I saw Bill Donahue and a rabbi and an atheist. And when you were talking about, you know, that we have to pray for the Jewish people, I'm thinking, and they were talking about Obama going after the Christians. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that I think that will draw Christians and Jewish people more together, and maybe that'd be another way of evangelizing, you know. So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, that's an excellent point, and I think we do see that effect, that as the government, as the federal government in particular, is becoming more and more hostile to any religion in the public square, then people who take religion seriously are bonding together to resist that, and I think you're right. I think it is creating more of a union between the serious Christian community and the serious Jewish community, because they see this common enemy in this enforced atheism or secularism being imposed by the federal government. So I think that's an excellent point. And I've seen that in initiatives and so forth very gratifyingly. Mel Gibson, I happen to have personally experienced, have been present at this joint effort by a very orthodox, high-profile rabbi and Mel Gibson, who formed an alliance to oppose the City of Los Angeles has a cross on its seal, and the city council wanted to eliminate the cross, or the ACLU wanted to eliminate the cross, and Orthodox Jewish rabbi joined with the Catholic community in opposing that because, of course, they saw the common threat to the public display of religion there. So I think that's an excellent point, and that is a source of hope for unity in the near future. So thanks for that comment. Let me just quickly use the last 20 minutes to talk about the effect of the Holocaust on Jewish theology, which is basically the following. The basic tenets of Judaism are that God, of course, is all good, all loving, and all powerful. That's evident in the Old Testament. That the Jews are the chosen people, the special favorites of God. That is spelled out in the Old Testament. And the third element is that good will be rewarded in this life and evil will be punished in this life. That may be a little bit surprising to Catholics who understand that the ultimate reward for merit in this life and punishment for ill deeds in this life come in the afterlife, come in heaven or purgatory or hell. But that teaching is not apparent in Judaism. And in fact, Judaism explicitly teaches, the Old Testament explicitly teaches, that good will be rewarded in this life and evil will be punished in this life. To support that, let me read the Shema. Now, the Shema is the central prayer of Judaism. You can think of it as the Jewish version almost of the Our Father. In other words, pretty much whenever Jewish prayers are said, they include the Shema. And it's recited three times a day in the Jewish office and so forth. And it's just a passage from Leviticus that has been turned into the central prayer. By the way, if you know what a mezuzah is, which is that little box that is nailed to the doorposts of Jewish houses, that mezuzah, in fact, encloses a very small scroll on which some Jewish prayers are written, including from the Shema. So let me read the Shema. If you will earnestly heed the commandments which I have for you this day, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul, then I will favor your land with rain at the proper season, rain in autumn and rain in spring, so that you will have an ample harvest of grain and wine and oil. I will assure grass in the fields for your cattle. You will eat to contentment. Take care lest you be tempted to forsake God and turn to false gods and worship them. For then the wrath of the Lord will be directed against you. He will close up the heavens and there will be no rain. The earth will not yield her produce. You will soon disappear from the good land which the Lord is giving you. End of the Shema, or end of the summary of the Shema. So you see there the explicit teaching that if you serve the Lord properly, you will be rewarded in this life with a long life and with ample crops and so forth. And if you turn away from the Lord, you will be punished with famine and so forth. So then let's turn to the Holocaust. Basically, how is the Jewish community after the Holocaust going to deal with the fact of the Holocaust? Here you had the greatest catastrophe to ever befall the Jewish people, certainly since the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and how can you reconcile this with an all-good, all-powerful, all-loving God for whom the Jews are the chosen people and who promises that any disaster that befalls in this life will in fact be a punishment for behavior in this life and so forth? There's just really no way to maintain all of those tenets of old-time Judaism in the face of the Holocaust. And tragically, many of the leading figures of Jewish theology in the second half of the 20th century have responded to the conundrum of the Holocaust by deciding that either God is not all-powerful and doesn't have control over human affairs, or that he, God forbid, isn't even so good after all. Now, that last statement, that they have responded by saying that God isn't so good, is truly scandalous, and I apologize for the blasphemy of it, and I apologize for even having to mention it, but I have to because It is so apparent in Jewish theology from the second half of the 20th century. Let me read some quotes again to support that statement. First of all, Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg is perhaps the highest profile, was the highest profile American Jewish rabbi of the second half of the 20th century. He was the president of the American Jewish Congress. He was the head of the Jewish community in the sense that he was the one who was continually invited to the White House to discuss with Nixon or to discuss with Carter issues having to do with the Jewish people. He wrote probably a dozen books on Judaism, including one called Judaism, which is a even today, 50 years after it was written, a basic kind of textbook on what Judaism teaches and so forth. And he had grown up Orthodox. In fact, he came from a Hasidic family. But let me read a sentence from his own memoirs. In his memoirs, which he wrote around the year 2000, near the end of his life, he wrote, quote, "I was aware then in 1948 that I could never return to the Orthodox faith in God. I would not forgive him for the Holocaust, and I would not absolve him by agreeing that the death camps had existed in a realm that he could not control." End of quote. These are his words, and I regret that he said them, and I think we should all throw up a prayer. You know, he's now departed. A prayer for the state of his soul, wherever it may be. But he is saying explicitly he couldn't return to the Orthodox Jewish faith. He would not forgive God for the Holocaust, and he would not absolve him by admitting that he had no control over it. So that is, in black and white, this tragedy, one example of this particular tragedy that the fact of the Holocaust had on the theology of many Jews, including this really leading leader of Jewish theology after the Holocaust, that basically they gave up on God's goodness. Now, perhaps even more shockingly, one finds the same theme permeating the writings of Elie Wiesel. More of our listeners probably are aware of who Elie Wiesel is. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for his writings about the Holocaust. I don't have in front of me his curriculum vitae or whatever, but he's absolutely, he's still alive, by the way, thank God. He still writes and teaches on Jewish theology and on the Holocaust. He's the last that I looked into it, he was a professor at Boston University, chaired professor. Anyway, a very, very high profile representative of post-Holocaust Jewish theology. And let me read some quotes from his, which show this terrible crisis in Jewish theology produced by the Holocaust. So these are now what follows is some quotes of Elie Wiesel. "This was the meaning of the Holocaust. It implicated not only Abraham or his son, but their God as well." Another quote of his about the Holocaust. "In the endless engagement with God, we the Jews proved to him that we were more patient than he and more compassionate also." Okay? So the Holocaust proved that we the Jews were more patient than God and more compassionate than God. This is this horrible reversal of basically who's good and who's bad, and portraying God as basically bad for having allowed the Holocaust, which has become a tragic undertone in much of Jewish theology after the Holocaust. Again, I apologize for bringing this up, but to the extent that our listeners want to understand what's going on in the heart and soul of Jewish theology now and why it's so critical to bring Jews to the truth of Jesus, this is kind of supports that effort. Let me read a couple of more quotes from Elie Wiesel and then get out of this kind of darkness. Okay, so This is from an essay that Elie Wiesel wrote on the story of Job in the Old Testament. I was offended by Job's surrender in the text. Job's resignation as man was an insult to man. He should not have given in so easily. He should have continued to protest. He should have said to God, by accepting your inequities, do I not become your accomplice? But he did not suffer in vain. Thanks to him, we know that it is given to man to transform divine injustice into human justice and compassion. So again, end of quote, again, this reversal that the Holocaust proved that God is wicked, that God is unjust, and that the nobility of man lies in proving to God that we are more compassionate than he is, and that we transform his injustice into justice and compassion. So I'm going to get off this immediate topic right now because it's, of course, extremely upsetting and extremely tragic. But you can see that since Judaism has no understanding of the redemptive value of suffering, you can see why the Holocaust ended up leading so much of Jewish theology into this dead end. Now, let me just give the Catholic response, because the Catholic chance, the Catholic Church has all the answers. The Catholic Church has all the answers to the problems of the meaning of life, to the problems of life that result in everybody else being in despair and tying themselves in knots. And that is a reason for evangelizing as Catholics. That's a reason for bringing others into the Catholic Church, in addition to all the gifts of the sacraments, and in addition to the implications for the afterlife, simply the peace of mind and the sanity, which is only available through knowing what the Catholic Church teaches, and in the context of this conversation, what the Catholic Church teaches with respect to the redemptive value of suffering, and the reason why an all-good, all-powerful God allows so much suffering in the world. Because, of course, we know as Catholics that the one time that God became man, he became man primarily to suffer and die. That certainly shows the infinite value, redemptive value of suffering. Let me just now read some quotes that kind of underline that. First of all, from the Second Vatican Council, this is obvious to all of us, but it's a beautiful passage. Only in the mystery of the incarnate word does the mystery of man take on light. In fact, Christ, the final Adam, fully reveals man to himself and makes his supreme calling clear. Through Christ and in Christ, the riddles of sorrow and death grow meaningful. Through Christ and in Christ, the riddles of sorrow, death, and suffering grow meaningful. And without Christ, there is no answer to the riddles of sorrow and death and suffering. This is just a sentence or two from Pope John Paul II on the last passage that I just read. If these words refer to everything that concerns the mystery of man, they certainly refer in a very special way to human suffering. Precisely at this point, the revealing of man to himself and making his supreme vocation clear is particularly indispensable. In other words, the supreme vocation of man is made clear only in addressing the mystery of human suffering and recognizing the infinite redemptive value that human suffering has, and in fact, that there's no more valuable or precious aspect to human life than our suffering united with the suffering of Christ, which brings about the conversion of sinners and the redemption of all of mankind. I'll read a couple of quotes more directly related to Elie Wiesel and this issue of the Jews' response to the Holocaust. Let me close the show today with reading some quotes from Edith Stein. I think that most of you are familiar with who Edith Stein was. She was a Orthodox Jewish woman who was born in Eastern Europe at the turn of the century. She lost her faith as an adolescent. She became an extraordinary philosopher and philosophy professor as an atheist. But then in her 20s, her eyes were gradually opened to the truth of Christ. She entered the Catholic Church. She became a Carmelite nun. She ended up dying at Auschwitz, and she has since been canonized as a saint and made co-patroness of Europe. And in fact, the center of her life's work, her final theological work that she was actually writing as she was arrested by the Gestapo and taken to the extermination camp, was called The Science of the Cross. And the name that she took when she became a Carmelite was Sister Teresa Benedicta de Cruce, which is frequently translated Sister Teresa, blessed of the cross, Benedicta of the cross. But in fact, she took it meaning Sister Teresa blessed by the cross, because she understood that there is no greater blessing than the cross. So let me close with some words that she wrote about the horror of the Holocaust in her recognition of the redemptive value of suffering. So these are the words of Edith Stein, of Saint Edith Stein. I spoke with the Savior to tell him I realized it was his cross that was now being laid upon the Jewish people, that the few who understood this had the responsibility of carrying it in the name of all, and that I myself was willing to do that if he would only show me how. I left with the conviction that I had been heard, but uncertain as ever as to what carrying the cross would mean for me. Later she wrote, this is the shadow of the cross that falls upon my people, if only they would only realize that is the fulfillment of the curse which my people have called down upon themselves. I understood the cross as the destiny of God's people, which was beginning to be apparent at the time. This is 1933 that she wrote this. I felt that those who understood the cross of Christ should take it upon themselves on everybody's behalf. Beneath the cross, I understood the destiny of God's people. End of quote. Of course, this is obviously true. No one was more God's people than Jesus. Jesus was God's only begotten Son. If Jesus' destiny should be the cross, it's only logical that the special people of God's destiny should be the cross. So let me read her spiritual last testament, final testament and will that she wrote in 1939. I joyfully accept in advance the death God has appointed for me in perfect submission to his most holy will. May the Lord accept my life and death for the honor and glory of his name, for the needs of his holy church, and for the Jewish people, that the Lord may be received by his own and his kingdom come in glory. Let me perhaps read another quote of hers if I have a moment, and then I will just close. Here's some more quotes of hers about the blessing of the cross. And I'm reading this to show, just contrast the problem that Jewish theology without an understanding of Christ and the cross has with respect to the Holocaust versus the total resolution of the problem that comes with the understanding that we have as Catholics. This is St. Edith Stein again. Human activities cannot help us, but only the suffering of Christ. It is my desire to share in it. So that's really the bottom line. That is what we know as Catholics. Human activities cannot help us, but only the suffering of Christ. We know that the answer to all of the problems of the world lie in our earnest prayer and our acceptance of suffering united with the sufferings of Christ. This is true throughout our lives, and this is true the darker things are around us, the more suffering which we find ourselves in, the more necessary it is to cling to this bedrock of the Catholic faith. So with that, I've come to the end of my time. I'm sorry I didn't have quite enough time to go everywhere I wanted to go, but I hope this has been of use to you, and I promise that if you join me again next week, we'll be on a little bit of a happier note. That's all for now. Thanks for tuning in to Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman on Radio Maria. And please join us again next week, same place, same time.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.